Carmen Jeleen Cruz served as the mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico from 2013 to 2020. When Hurricane Maria devastated the island of Puerto Rico in 2017, she worked to support the millions of Puerto Ricans who were impacted by the hurricane and the long-term power outages. She has received countless awards and recognition for her leadership during and after Hurricane Maria, including being named on the Time magazine list of the 100 most influential people in the world. Cruz served as mayor through the end of last year and now serves as a distinguished fellow in leadership at the Weissman Center at Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley, Massachusetts. I spoke with her last week at a Bennington College Kappa Center for the Advancement of Public Action event, where we discussed climate justice, the role of women leaders, especially during crisis, lessons learned from Hurricane Maria and Irma, and how climate change is leading to migration away from Puerto Rico. It is a delight to welcome Carmen Jeleen Cruz to the roundtable this morning.
Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you here.
Thank you very much. And thank you to President Walker and to Judith Eng. We worked together for a very long time, and I'm sure we will continue to get into some sort of trouble together in the next few years.
Let me begin with this. A year ago, March 2020, let's say, late February, March, really into March, when people were starting to question how the Trump administration was going to respond to a crisis like COVID, there was great concern as to how that was going to go. Now, we had an idea of how it was going to go, but many people started to write that the roadmap and what we could look at was what you, Jeleen Cruz, went through in Puerto Rico in San Juan as the mayor. I am curious as to the connection you make between those two things. And as we sit here in March of 2021, what we could have avoided and what you learned through not only what you lived through as mayor, but what you have gone through over the past 12 months?
Well, first of all, around that time, I started getting calls from reporters, and I said, look, President Trump at the time started to exhibit his particular brand of racism, of intolerance, of inefficiency and bureaucracy right after Hurricanes Irma and Maria. Most people think of Maria on September 20th. But 14 days before, we had been hit in the same trajectory and with the same strength by Hurricane Irma. And we had no electricity at the time that Hurricane Maria hit. So it's like being hit by Muhammad Ali on one of those 1-2 punch combinations. Mm-hmm. You don't see where the punch is coming from, but you're lights out. And literally, we were lights out. Most of the island of Puerto Rico did not have electricity for 12 months. And the particular bureaucracy and inefficiency of the president at the time really cost the lives of thousands of people. So I started to say that President Trump had begun to practice his disaster mode in Puerto Rico, and I called Puerto Rico his dress rehearsal. You know how before a major theater production, you have a dress rehearsal.
Right.
Because he had only been in power for about 8 months when all hell broke loose in Puerto Rico. The problem was that, and this is, I'm going to go to the second part of your question. The thing that I learned the most about a crisis is that there's only two decisions that you have to make. One, are you going to stand up and tell the truth? Or two, are you going to be complicit with a narrative that will tolerate inefficiency and allow people to turn their back on those that need it the most? At the time, I stood up. because I was seeing people dying around me. I would do it again. That came with its, with a price to pay, but I would do it again. I have no regrets about doing it. But one of the things that was evident from the beginning is that the president made this crisis about him. It was about him and about how good he could look politically. So at one point when I called him on, I think it was CNN or PBS, and he wrote that famous tweet that said, "The crazy mayor of San Juan, nasty woman." I replied by saying, "Mr. President, this is not about politics. This is about saving lives." So the second thing that I learned about a crisis is that ultimately it is about saving lives. Primarily, it is about saving lives, and that politics really have no place in this. And lastly is you have to tell the truth. And this was not about the leaders. It was about the people that were going through life-threatening situations and lost their lives.
Not only did, not that you need me to repeat this, but not only did he call you a nasty woman, he called you a horror show. He called you grossly incompetent. And meanwhile, people are dying, and you are trying to figure out what is going on. You had had enough. Earlier, at the beginning of the crisis, you, I believe a Trump administration official earlier in the day said that they were doing good and it was a good news story. The relief efforts out of Puerto Rico, they were a good news story. By the end of the day, you were there saying Mayday, calling for help, saying that you were mad as hell. And you were standing in front of pallets of water sent for distribution. And you said, "Look, we're dying here. And if we don't get the food and water into people's hands, we're going to see something close to a genocide." So
and that's... Joe, excuse me for interrupting. When I said the word genocide, it was rampant all over the negative reaction. People called me hysterical, which, of course, they would not call a man hysterical. But they call me hysterical. They said I was exaggerating it. And those pallets of water that I had was the first shipment that we received of aid. And it was not from the federal government. It was from the people of Chicago and the Puerto Rican diaspora in Chicago. And by chance, we had received them on that same day.
So to your point, a man would not be treated that way. I want you to talk, though, about leadership and what it was internally in you as you've been able to look back on it that worked. You are now a distinguished fellow in leadership at the Weissman Center at Mount Holyoke College. Leadership. What does that now mean to you? And through the experience and what you saw, not only in those early days, but later, but even well, months later, from not only the federal government, but from the governor of Puerto Rico, did you become disillusioned with leadership and what leadership is and can be?
There is a difference between leading in a good time or in happy days, leading in a crisis and leading chaos. And what we had at the time was chaos. No food, no water, no medication. Doctors had to operate with a light on their cell phones. Literally food for only 3 weeks. We had purchased in the municipality of San Juan food for 2 months. So I had food to give to people. We ate at 65 elderly homes. But yes, I did become disillusioned with leadership because leadership seemed to me at the time a vanity fest. You remember that Carly Simon's song, You're So Vain, you probably think the song is about you. Well, leaders were so vain, they thought the crises was about them and how and a platform to make them look good. But then I found solace in the streets of San Juan, in the people. I would go to a neighborhood and say, I'm sorry it's taken me so long to get here, and would literally break down and cry. And people would hug me and say, don't worry, Mayor, you're here. That's what counts. We're going to make it. So in a time of chaos, I found out that leadership was not so much to be in front of the people, but a lot of being with the people, a lot of sharing in their pain. That's why I lived in the largest shelter in Puerto Rico, which was in San Juan, run by the municipality, for 3 months, because I decided that if, while the president was in Mar-a-Lago playing golf, we were living in shelters. And I decided that if the people that had elected me to run City Hall were living in shelters, that I could not be at my home. So leadership became more of a connection with people, and it became more of a synergy with people than a top-down type of relationship.
So tell me what it was like after you had been called the names that you were called by the President of the United States, when he finally comes to Puerto Rico to visit the devastation of the hurricane. There is a most famous photo of you shaking his hand with your right hand and your left hand behind your back. It would only be more perfect if your middle finger was out, but it's still pretty great. How does that happen?
Well, I get a call literally from the White House, and I thought they were kidding. I said, you know, this is the White House Situation Room, I think they said. And I said, yeah, and I'm Mary Poppins. And I hung up. I kept walking. There, Mayor, this is truly the White House. And I said, listen, I have a lot of F work to do. Don't call me again. And they said, call this number. And I dialed the number and said, White House offer. And I thought, oh my God. And they said, look, the president is coming to Puerto Rico. He's inviting a group of mayors. He would like you to be there. After that, before that, we had already had our sparring internet Twitter session. And I said, look, I don't know if I'll be there. And then I got a call from the resident commissioner of Puerto Rico, who's a Republican and Trump supporter, and said, you make the decision that you want. But I just want you to know that this invitation is coming straight from the White House. So I decided to go, because after all, I don't represent myself. I represent my constituents. If it was up to me, I would have not dignified him with the presence that symbolized what the people of San Juan were in front of him. But it was not up to him. And I represented those that cared for him as well as the ones that did not care for him. So I go visit him at the airport. And in the airport in Puerto Rico, the main airport, there's an area reserved for the Army and Air Force. And we are there together, and he's walking around saying hello to everybody. And he turns around and puts his back on me and doesn't want to say hello. And the media says, Mr. President, the mayor of San Juan is here. The mayor, so, you know, I honestly have to hold my hand, because I have been told that he liked to pull people in. So as he came towards me, I didn't put my hand out first, because I was not going to take too very well if he didn't shake my hand. Not me, do whatever you want to me, but it's the people that I represent that you have to respect. So when he put his hand out, I pulled him in. And I don't know if it's appropriate to say it, but
go ahead.
Everything you've heard about his hands is true.
Okay.
every comment you've ever heard, it's true. So we'll skip that and get that out of the way. And I told him, I said, Mr. President, this is not about politics. This is about saving lives. He totally dismissed me. He's very tall. I'm very short. He looked over me and he said, thank you, everybody. And then went on to continue to insult the people of Puerto Rico. That is a famous time when he says, I don't know if you know Puerto Rico, but you have thrown our budget out of whack with all the money that we have thrown down here. That is the time he says, how many dead people are there? Oh, such a small number. Oh, well, you're doing great. You know, this is not a disaster then. It's not a crisis. And that afternoon was the time that he disrespected not only the people of Puerto Rico, but I believe the values of the American people. When he shamed the United States by throwing paper towels at a group of people that were there to see him and to perhaps hear the words that a commander in chief should be bestowing upon people at a time like that. It was an embarrassing moment for the presidency. It was a very painful moment for us as Puerto Ricans. And I think it was a very painful and embarrassing moment for the majority of the decent people in the United States that know that the United States is better than that.
You mentioned a moment ago about how not only was it Hurricane Maria, but also Hurricane Irma just days before. While all of this is happening, you have to be just waiting for the next storm as well. So I'd like to talk to you about that, about how climate change and the issues associated with it that so affect Puerto Rico and so affect San Juan, and how, while you are, as you spoke a moment ago, leading in crisis, you are also trying to perhaps plan for the future and batten down the hatches for what we're told is going to be an increase of these killer storms.
And in addition to that, Joe, I said something that, again, was really taken badly by people in Puerto Rico. I said, we will no longer be able to hide away our poverty and our discrimination, because it is presumed and talked about 30 million trees died after Hurricanes Irma and Maria. And when you went to all areas in Puerto Rico, it looked like there had been a fire, because, you know, the seawater, which was hot, was hitting the trees and really burnt the trees. So not only are we, like you say, going through the crises, but we know hurricane season is not over until November 30th. And we're getting other things. I just showed you a photograph of a massive wave, because we had a tidal wave. It was massive, and coastal storms, massive, that disrupted, again, all of the coastal areas of San Juan and the rest of Puerto Rico. But one of the things that all of a sudden you were told, this is going to continue to happen. Storms are going to get closer and they're going to get stronger. And I have to tell you, for me, climate change was just a phrase that people sipping tea or, you know, cafe latte talked about. You know, it didn't mean anything. It was something that happened to somebody else. But I had some very young people in the staff that I worked with, and they had made a point of nagging. That was my way of thinking at the time, about whatever we built in San Juan, let's put solar lighting. And I'm like, oh my God, let me shut up this kid and tell them that it's okay. So when I became a convert about the need for solar power was a week after Hurricane Maria. We were walking into one of the deepest rural areas in San Juan. 60% of San Juan is rural. What most people see is the beautiful sides of old San Juan. So everyone thinks San Juan is a very urban area, but 60% is rural. And I kept seeing a light literally far away. We didn't know what it was. And as we walked towards it, it was one of the solar lampposts that we had put in a project that we had built that had been bent. It was made out of steel. It had been bent by the winds, but the light was still working. And people were congregated around it because it was the only light they had for miles. And that made me a convert. I really decided then and there that, number one, everything that we built in San Juan from there on, and I did it through an executive order, it became public policy in the municipality, will be built, which as more resilient, we call them resilient steps, as we could have. One of them was solar lighting. The other one was rain harvesting. And the other one was water purification. Because when you lose power, in most places in Puerto Rico, you lose your ability to get water because water is pumped up. So we began building homes, and we built a community, very small community, nine homes in the place that Judith was mentioning, El Caño Martín Peña. It's called Villa Esperanza, Hopeville. Those houses can withstand hurricanes of up to 170 miles per hour, can withstand, and they withstood the earthquakes up to 7.0, have their own solar system, and the entire house is solarized. It's none of this thing you have a little battery and you can run your TV and then you can run your refrigerator. Everything runs in solar. They have 300-gallon cisterns of water. Everything we built from there on became a sustainability issue for the small projects and for the large projects. And I honestly think it's not the way of the future. It's what we need to do right now.
Carmen Yulín Cruz is the former mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico, and our guest on the roundtable, currently serving as a distinguished fellow in leadership at the Weissman Center. Yulín, let's talk about the fact that while you were able to do that in parts of the city, what is happening throughout the rest of Puerto Rico is the aging power grid, which is down, is brought back to life, kind of, but not to improve it as you just explained for the future. So, in other words, there is no infrastructure in place for future storms, which helps in this idea for people to leave, to flee, because they know the next storm is coming and they know that nothing really has been repaired. So they become refugees from the place that they have lived, most have lived all their lives. How did you suggest at the time that be dealt with? How do you believe we should deal with it now?
Two things. One of the things that happened is that about 300,000 people fled Puerto Rico the first 2-3 months. And in the first 6 months, 500,000, half a million Puerto Ricans left Puerto Rico. But there was another migration within the island of Puerto Rico. People were moving from the rural areas of Puerto Rico in with families, not perhaps families that have electricity, but families that had a generator, families that had a cistern. That's what was happening. And then it is amazing how one crisis breeds another crisis. It's almost as is when you throw a stone into or a rock into a pond or a lake and you see all those ripples that keep growing and growing and growing. That's exactly what kept happening. So, and Judith was part of this also. We started, first of all, making sure and making aware members of Congress that we needed a waiver to the Stafford Act, the act that gives life to FEMA. Because the Stafford Act says that you have to rebuild what you found. And I kept saying, I don't want to rebuild a home that has a zinc roof and wooden walls, because in a year or two or whenever, when it huffs and puffs, I'm going to lose that house again, and I'm going to have to rebuild it. Not only is it not good for the people, it's not good for the taxpayers as a whole, because we are not looking for permanent solution to recurring problems. And that became a phrase. I even had a T-shirt that said, look for permanent solutions to recurring problems. But what happened is that millions of dollars were spent by the American taxpayer and by the Puerto Rican taxpayer in putting together a power grid. The transmission, not the generation, the transmission part of that power grid to the exact specifications than before. Puerto Rico is an island of 100 by 35 miles wide. So imagine that you think that each one, if you divide it in four quadrants, that each one of those are going to have a power generation unit. Well, that's not what happens. The southern part of Puerto Rico generates the power for the entire island of Puerto Rico. And it has to go through mountains and mountaintops and valleys and so forth. So these literal cables are hanging up, you know, hundreds of feet above the ground in conditions that when the next hurricanes come, they're going to be blown to pieces. In the city, you can see the cables all over the city when we could very easily, and I suggested this, put the cables underneath the pavement, as you see it in many cities in the States, so that when another hurricane happened, we wouldn't have to face the same thing. But you see, Joe, the problem is that your mentality and your frame of mind has to be in the right place. I've understood to a great pain to the people of Puerto Rico that climate change kills, that people die because of climate change. And when you add to climate change the bureaucratic and inefficient ways of governments to deal with this, it is the perfect storm. So the Stafford Act needs to be changed, number one, so that it allows for more sensible solutions to be put forth. And number two, we shouldn't have to wait until the president declares a state of emergency in order to know what level of aid a city or a state is going to get. You know, we should have predestined, if it's a category one and the loss of businesses, et cetera, is estimated at X amount of dollars, this is what you're going to get before the president opens his or her mouth at some point. This is what you're going to get. Then if it's more than that, this is what you're going to get. You know, we have hurricanes category 1 through 5, but we don't have levels of policies 1 through 5. And that would be very easy to deploy. The other thing is that we need to take specific routes in building in a resilient manner and in making sure that solar power and clean energy and a Green New Deal, really, we start forging that today and don't wait another second.
I am curious as to, we talked about, obviously, your relationship with the President of the United States, such as it was, but you are the mayor of a large city, And the governor, Ricardo Rossello, is, while you are saying this is horrible, what is being done, you are leaving us to die here, and we are in great peril. The governor, who I will say later on was removed from office, and for text messages that were released that included endorsing the idea of you being shot, I would add, of how do you then, I guess I'm looking for how you even found the I don't want to say courage, but to be able to go on and to even bring up the things that you just talked about, because you know people are migrating, you know people are leaving, you know people, you know another storm is coming and something needs to be done, and you're looking around and you're not finding, you mentioned the people, of course, which is that is wonderful, but you are also looking for leadership yourself and not finding it. So for someone who is in your position and others who will find themselves in your position, how do they move and navigate to get things done until something like a Green New Deal is passed?
You mentioned the word courage.
Yes.
And what I was fearful. I was fearful that I will continue to see people die. I want everybody that is listening to us to imagine the quietest place they have ever been in their life. And I'm sure that for most of those listening, that would mean a place of peace. To us, that is truly the calm, not only before the storm, but within the storm. There is a moment in a hurricane where, as the eye is coming through, it's almost hypnotically peaceful. Not a sound can be heard. And it's almost like a very angelical place. At that point, you have to think of what will be lost if you don't open your mouth. So for me, it was fear of losing more people, fear of what people will find or not find when they got out of the shelters, fear that an entire generation would be left with these huge scars in their soul because we didn't do enough. So very quickly I'll tell you, my grandmother, who you can see for those of you that are watching now, right here behind me in a photograph, she was a very poor woman, dead poor, no food poor, no shoes poor. She was so poor, she graduated from high school the same day my dad graduated from sixth grade. And she worked at a cafeteria in New York City. She moved from Puerto Rico to New York City to be educated at NYU. She worked in a cafeteria there at night so my father could eat there during the day. So I know how hard people have to work to put food on the table. And that to me was the burning force. But she told me, I was very little, I'm 5 feet tall. I was very little. And once I got beat up in the sandbox and she asked me what happened. I told her and she said, well, let me tell you something. You're very little. So you're gonna get one chance to hit, one, just one. So you have to hit as hard as you can, run as fast as you can, and scream as loud as you can. And I swear to you, in the middle of the darkness and in the middle of that deafening silence, I remember those words. Hit as hard as you can, run as fast as you can, and shout as hard as you can. But you also find inspiration from the people around you, from your coworkers, from those that left their homes to take care of somebody else's home, from the women that went and put a rope on one side of the river and on the other side of the river so that they could take their children and bring them to get some nebulizer therapy for their asthma, from the communities that rise up and understand that we're not going to wait for government to get here. We're going to do it ourselves. So you find inspiration in the fact that there is an entire generation of people old in age and people young in age that are seeing the future in a different way and that are no longer thinking that this is not real, but because we are experiencing what is real. And we think about this, Joe, it's like a circle of life, like the Lion King.
Right.
We look at the migration in Latin America and Central America. A lot of those people, yes, some of them are fleeing from violence. Yes, some of them are fleeing because they don't have opportunities. But a lot of them are fleeing because there are problems, flooding, earthquakes, hurricanes, fires, all of these things that have to do with climate change that really push them towards looking for a better life. And that it is the essence of now, and it's the urgency of now. So if we want to have air to breathe in a couple of years, we have to take action today.
We just have a few minutes left, and I have two large questions for you. So we'll get those out of the way here as we conclude. One is the current governor of Puerto Rico, Pedro Pierluisi, supports statehood. You do not. I'm curious as to, and you ran for governor, and you lost in the primary. And ended your time as mayor of San Juan at the end of last year. How overriding is that issue of statehood? And is that what wins and loses elections in Puerto Rico, number one? And number two, what will it take for that matter to be resolved efficiently?
What wins and loses elections is the fear that is put in people's souls. Anyone that is a progressive, anyone that wants people to go to school and not pay, students to go to the university and not pay, equal access to a good healthcare system, that we want our teachers to be paid an appropriate salary, that we want to raise the minimum wage, those people like me are called socialists and communists. And people in Puerto Rico are very fearful because they have the Cuba experience that some consider bad and some consider good. So being branded a socialist and being branded too liberal, being branded a communist just because you have a progressive agenda, wins or loses elections in Puerto Rico. But it is an overriding issue. I support free association, but more than that, I support a process of self-determination. And what the American people understand very eagerly is that we do not like being a colony of the United States, and the American people do not like having a colony on this day and age. It is a blemish in the U.S., going to other countries to tell them that they have to treat people with respect and dignity and respect their civil rights and their human rights when they are not respecting our civil rights and our human rights. So Nidia Velázquez and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have reintroduced the bill, and I think they're going to reintroduce it next week, which already has 75 sponsors, co-sponsors in the House of Representatives. And it talks about a binding process. And it talks about a committee, a bilateral committee between the U.S. and Puerto Rico. And people say, but aren't Puerto Ricans U.S. citizens? Yes, we are, by birth since 1917. But we are a nation. And when you put boots on the ground and you invade another nation, the least you could do, the progressive things to do, the liberal thing to do is to let the people of Puerto Rico decide what they want their relationship with the United States to be. So I am all for a process of self-determination where non-territorial and non-colonial alternatives are put forth to the people of Puerto Rico.
What is the number of people who died as a result in San Juan of those two storms?
Well, the majority of the people that died in Puerto Rico are listed as dying in San Juan because we are, of course, the capital city. And a lot of the people were brought into San Juan. But it is the entirety of Puerto Rico, it's about 3,000 people. And it's estimated that between 300 to 400 of those were native people from San Juan.
How soul scarring is that for you, knowing that you shouted, wowed, and you did as your mother told you to do from that sandbox experience?
Well, I was talking to somebody today, and I'll tell you what I told that person. Nobody should have to play God in their lifetime. When I made decisions of where to take the help first, that meant that other people weren't getting the help then. It isn't the smiles of those that I helped that stayed with me. It is the gasps for air and the silence and the lack of gasoline on generators that stay with me every day. And I just hope that they know that we didn't get to them because we couldn't. And not that we didn't get to them because they weren't important. We should have slept a little less. We should have eaten one meal a day and not two. We should have shouted more. And you see, the thing about climate change and crises is that those who have less are the ones that get hit the hardest. Those that have the money got on a private plane and left. Or like Senator Ted Cruz, who didn't like what he was getting in Texas, got on a plane and went to Cancun, right? But the ones that are left there, most of them are left because they don't have a choice. And as government and as a society, we need to make it work for everybody. Because I can tell you that this past September, we put 3,000 Puerto Rican flags in the largest park in Puerto Rico, which is in San Juan. And when you see that and you realize that is somebody's mother, somebody's father, somebody's daughter or sister or child, you understand what climate change does. It kills. And it kills now, not 10 years from now. So for the rest of my life, I will wonder if I did as much as I could. And I remember, and I'll close with this, at one point a reporter, I think it was Hunter Walker, asked the president what, from 1 to 10, what he gave himself, and he said a 10. I'm the best thing that has ever happened to Puerto Rico. Well, despite that his response was totally devout of reality, I think true leadership does not give themselves a grade when people's lives have been lost. True leadership is never satisfied because there's always something more than could have been done. For the rest of my life, I will have no regrets, but for the rest of my life, the 3,000 lives lost will weigh more than all of the ones we saved.
I am glad to hear you say the no regret part, and I hope you also know that each of those smiles that you did receive was because of the heroic work that you were able to do and that was done, and the people who have their lives because of the work of you and your amazing team. Thank you so much for being with us. It has been an absolute honor to speak to you, and I so appreciate you. I so appreciate your spirit, and I so appreciate the time you gave us. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Carmen Jolene Cruz served as mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico through the end of 2020, now serves as a distinguished fellow in leadership at the Weissman Center at Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley, Massachusetts. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.